Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, June 13th, 2024. New Board Reinvigorates Marfa Chamber of Commerce by Mary Cantrell. MKCANTRELL at BigBendSentinel.com. Marfa. The Marfa Chamber of Commerce, a local nonprofit that has been around in some form or fashion since 1912, is under new leadership after a brief period of board restructuring following the November resignation of previous president Abby Boyd. Joe Williams, owner of Big Bend Coffee Roasters, has been reappointed as the chamber's president, having served in the role once before. Yasmin Guevara is serving as vice president, Lindsay Smith as secretary, and Kate Calder as treasurer. Board members at large include Hector Sanchez, Mandy Sanchez, Parker Sanchez, Laura McShann, Kendall Craig, and Trene Cardona Jr. Williams said the new team is incredibly enthusiastic about leading the chamber into its next chapter and continuing the tradition of hosting the Marfa Lights Festival, a beloved homecoming event in its 37th year. All of a sudden, we had a handful of people who were excited about doing it again, Williams said. This year's Marfa Lights is set to take place from Friday, August 30th to Sunday, September 1st. Williams said the musical acts on stage are already booked for the three-day fest, and plans are underway to recruit vendors and organize the Marfa Lights parade. The Big Bend Sentinel will announce the musical lineup soon. Guevara, the office manager for the Judd Foundation, is in her second year with the chamber and said it was super important for the Marfa Lights Festival to continue this year. Honestly, I couldn't imagine not having one this year, just because it's been an important festival to the community, even to the people who left the community, Guevara said. New board members are generating fresh ideas for the festival, she said, but the chamber also plans to keep it classic, sticking to Mexican music, Tejano music, country, and trying to keep that alive as it's been going on for 37 years, Guevara said. The city of Marfa awarded the forthcoming 37th annual Marfa Lights Festival $13,500 in hot grants, and the chamber recently held a well-attended fundraiser in the form of a Mario Kart tournament at Bitter Sugar, which raised $880 for the event. Beyond Marfa Lights, Williams said the chamber plans to continue community events established by previous leadership, like the Easter egg hunt and Christmas bazaar. Guevara said she'd like to see the chamber offer more community events in the form of dances and activities for local kids, something as simple as a summer cookout with a bounce house, ways for families to come and enjoy their time with their kids here in Marfa, she said. Most people would travel to Alpine, Fort Davis. I know that could be hard for some people around here, so we want something in our own hometown, Guevara said. Smith, who co-owns Bitter Sugar with her husband, Adam Boyd, said chamber leaders have also discussed the possibility of expanding programming to include lunch and learns for local business owners and resume writing and interviewing workshops for high school students. Smith, who worked in corporate advertising before moving to Marfa in August to start Bitter Sugar with Boyd, said she was eager to lend her expertise to the community and jumped at the chance to join the chamber when she heard they were looking for new members. We didn't want to just move here and open a business, Smith said, Both Adam and I wanted to be active members of the community. Williams said the group plans to grow the chamber's membership base and hold weekly meetings on Monday nights. For now, their focus will be on gaining exposure for Marfa's businesses, which he said are going strong and contributing to the town offerings. We have more businesses in Marfa now than ever before. Even 5 years ago, particularly 10 years ago, we've got good, solid businesses. That's pretty exciting, Williams said. We've got something to show off now, not just art. Photo by Sarah M. Vasquez. The Marfa Chamber of Commerce recently announced the addition of several new board members. Top row from left, Lindsay Smith, Joe Williams, Laura Buckshaw, and Hector Sanchez. Bottom row from left, Renee Cardona Jr., Yasmin Guevara, Kate Calder, and Parka Sanchez. Not pictured, Mandy Sanchez and Kendall Craig. Staff photo by Rob D'Amico. A family of Venezuelans scouts a path across the Rio Grande in Eagle Pass in September of 2023. Biden administration issues new asylum rules in hopes of relieving overwhelmed border. By Sam Karras. Sam at BigBenSentinel.com. Washington, D.C. Last week, the White House announced that it would be enforcing new rules limiting the asylum process for people entering the country illegally. The restrictions are designed to follow the ebb and flow of migration patterns, limiting asylum claims when the border is overwhelmed, according to a formula that tracks daily migrant encounters. The new rule comes on the heels of partisan disagreements over immigration reform. In a press release, the Biden administration accused Republicans in Congress of putting partisan politics ahead of national security after two attempts at a bipartisan border bill failed to advance. Republicans, on the other hand, have long criticized the Biden administration for what they fear are overly lax policies. If he was serious, he would have done this years ago, Texas Senator John Cornyn tweeted last week in response to the announcement. He is not serious. The right to asylum arose from major population displacement during World War II and was codified during the International Refugee Convention of 1951. Seeking asylum is a human right, and every person in the world has the right to apply for asylum if they are fleeing conflict or persecution, explains the United Nations Refugee Agency. They must not be expelled or returned to situations where their lives or freedoms would be in danger. After arrival in the United States, migrants can apply for asylum through U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. There are a few pathways to approval, but migrants flagged for expedited removal from the country must prove credible fear to an immigration official, essentially proving that there is a major risk to that individual of persecution or torture upon their return to their country of origin. Over the past few years, large influxes of migrants from countries like Venezuela and Haiti have turned the phrase asylum seekers into a political hot potato. In 2014, Customs and Border Protection, CBP, reported 47,799 claims filed. That number has exploded in the years since COVID, cresting to an all-time high of 487,518 in fiscal year 2023. As of the first quarter of this fiscal year, 1,032,940 claims remained pending, which could portend a fourfold increase from last year's 1,077,866. Immigration officials have attempted to close the gap through measures like CBP One, an app that allows asylum seekers to make appointments remotely. Scheduling an appointment in CBP1 continues to provide a safe, orderly, and humane process for non-citizens to access ports of entry, where CBP officers receive advance information for screening and vetting and to determine admissibility on case-by-case basis, the agency's website explains. While the availability of appointments has steadily increased, the app has been widely criticized for its glitches, and a major backlog of pending asylum cases remains. The Biden administration's new asylum policy will limit the number of claims that can be processed based on the number of daily migrant encounters. The policy only affects migrants who enter the country illegally outside a port of entry. If the weekly average of unauthorized border crossings is 1,500 or less for 14 consecutive days, claims will be processed as usual. However, if the border is overwhelmed by 2,500 daily crossings or more, the ability to apply for asylum will be temporarily suspended. The Washington Office on Latin America reported that the last time daily crossings were below the threshold was July 2020, a period when much of the world was under major COVID-19 restrictions. Currently, CBP1 appointments cannot be booked at the Presidio port of entry. The nearest locations are Paso del Norte in El Paso and the port of entry in Eagle Pass. Representative Tony Gonzalez, who represents El Paso, Presidio, and Eagle Pass in Congress, was not satisfied with the new restrictions. "This executive order by Joe Biden does nothing," he told CBS4 in El Paso. "It has no teeth." People of La Junta for Preservation receive historic Redford land donation by Sam Karras. Sam at BigBenSentinel.com. Redford. Last week, the people of La Junta for Preservation, a native-led nonprofit working to preserve important historic sites in the region, announced that they had received a historic land donation near the ancient El Povo crossing in Redford. The archaeological site is already protected as a state antiquities landmark and has a place on the National Register of Historic Places, but the donation will allow the site to be preserved and shared with the public under indigenous leadership. The site has been a migration pathway for centuries, marking a low spot in the water that connected cultures from all over the American Southwest and northern Mexico. Archaeological evidence suggests that, in addition to being the site of an early indigenous settlement, it was also the site of a Spanish mission about which few concrete details are known. In the 17th and 18th centuries, Spanish priests established missions in the area around the confluence of the Rio Conchos and the Rio Grande in hopes of converting the indigenous people in the region to Christianity. Historian and Povo native Enrique Madrid, who wrote the authoritative 2003 paper on the site, explained that piecing together the story of the Povo mission required cross-referencing archaeological evidence with oral history passed down generation by generation. "I grew up hearing stories of Indian villages and Spanish missions, of ghostly apparitions of women in white and spotted cows, of rattling chains and balls of fire, all indications of fabulous Spanish treasures and all phenomena associated with the old town of El Povo." He noted that the process of actually piecing together the evidence was not quite as glamorous as these rumors of buried treasure. Instead, he relied on elders with faint memories of the ruins of the mission site and uncovered historical photographs of the same. The remains of the adobe structures had been leveled in the 1950s at the landowner's request, which revealed even older evidence of indigenous settlement. Some mysteries still remain. The lost mission of El Povo is not lost in space, for we know what it looked like and its exact location, but rather it is lost in time, as we do not know when it was built or even what its name was, Madrid wrote. The El Povo site was donated by David Shane Duke, its owner for nearly two decades. El Povo is an incredibly special place to many, he wrote in a press release. The chapter of my brief ownership is closing, and I am excited to see what the future will bring. The people of La Junta for Preservation have experienced restoring sites in the region, according to an indigenous-led vision. This year saw the completion and grand opening of the Cementerio del Barrio de los Lipanes, a centuries-old traditional burial ground for the Lipan Apache. Executive Director Christina Hernandez was also looking forward to the future, with a focus on restoring native vegetation at the site and preserving an adobe structure, but noted that encroachment by development would present its own challenges. The site is not without complexities, and working to restore native habitats and creating safe access for the public is an exciting new project for us to tackle, she wrote. Fort Davis ISD reaps in big cash from private school partnerships. By Mary Cantrell, MKCANTRELL at BigBendSentinel.com. Tri-County. Fort Davis ISD's state aid dramatically rose from $70,000 to an estimated $1.5 million this past school year due to an enrollment increase from 170 to 486 students, made possible by new partnerships with private early childhood schools. The partnerships involve the exchange of paperwork, rather than hundreds of students, between the public school district and private schools. The $1.5 million the district is estimated to receive from the state this year will be split 50-50 with its partner organizations. FDISD implemented the Texas Education Agency program, utilized by 54 districts across the state as of last year, according to the agency, for the first time this school year to bolster its strained budget. The partnerships are one-year renewable legal agreements. The vast majority of districts engaged in these partnerships around the state contract with Head Start programs and private child care centers to dual-enroll preschool students only, not preschool through second grade like FDISD. The TEA initiative, introduced in 2003, was intended to enroll more children in pre-K by allowing districts to partner with existing programs, then work with the private entities to improve the quality of pre-K education. By dual enrolling pre-K through two students from seven schools, including Alpine Montessori, Alpine Christian School, and Wonder School Marfa, as well as several others across the state, the district received the basic allotment per each additional student, ranging from $3,000 to $6,160, which is then weighted upwards for specific student and district characteristics. In return, these private schools, which are still charging tuition, are getting payouts in the form of lease payments, payroll assistance, access to public school programs, and more. I think it's been extremely beneficial, said Fort Davis ISD Superintendent Graydon Hicks. We've been very successful in our partnerships, and they've been very positive. Hicks said additional money the district is bringing in is going towards salaries and district operating costs. It's also helping alleviate the district's annual recapture payments, funds the district sends to the state because it is considered to have excess wealth per student due to the combination of low enrollment and high property values. Last year, without the boost in enrollment, the district paid $25,000 in recapture payments. This year, Hicks is anticipating owing the state $0. Fort Davis ISD, with the given property values that the state mandated for 2023, I would have to have 500 kids to get out of the rich status, Hicks said. That is physically impossible in this area. If I don't have the partnerships, I wouldn't be able to do that. In addition to the three local schools, FDISD is also partnering with schools in El Paso, Monahans, and Burleson, south of Fort Worth. Next year, Hicks hopes to add schools from the Austin and Brazos Valley areas, growing the district's number of partnerships to 10 schools with up to 600 students enrolled. Hicks said the district has been contacted directly by other schools who want to partner with them, and several are connected to the district's new full-time deputy superintendent, Michelle Hartman, who implemented a similar program at Pawnee ISD in Bee County. The partner schools choose which specific students to dual enroll with FDISD. Hicks said the district recommends that early childhood education schools pursue local partnerships in the case of a special education or higher needs student so they can receive services locally, something FDISD is unable to provide to schools outside of the area. Hicks said the partnerships are beneficial for the private schools for a variety of reasons, and each individual deal is unique. It may be beneficial financially. It may be beneficial for licensing and regulation. It may be beneficial for recruitment, Hicks said. Private school partners are also able to gain greater access to state and federal grants through the public school district. FDISD is able to help pay for the salaries of employees pursuing additional certifications thanks to a grant from the University of Texas at El Paso. And this year, the district helped pay for security upgrades at a partner school with funds from a Safe Schools grant, ensuring they are in compliance with state safety requirements. This year, Alpine Montessori dual-enrolled 17 students with FDISD and is anticipating earning $100,000 from the partnership, a portion of which will cover Director Eliza Barton's salary for the year. Barton said school leaders were primarily financially motivated to enter into the partnership due to the fact that the school is a nonprofit that runs at a deficit and seeks grants and other ways to keep tuition affordable. For us, it comes down to what's best for children. Having resources, being fully funded, and having low fees are all what's best for the family and for us, and that's what's guided me and what still guides me into continuing the partnerships, Barton said. Being invited to tag along on FDISD field trips and having access to the district's school buses are added benefits, she said, and district personnel have been supportive on the administrative level. It's been wonderful, and everything the district said they were going to do, they did, Barton said. To me, they went above and beyond in each and every situation. The partnerships do involve a slew of additional administrative duties for both entities, particularly the public school district. Partner organizations are required to provide daily attendance records and beginning, middle, and end-of-year assessments tracking student progress. Because all students enrolled are pre-K through second graders, the STAR test is not required. FDISD coordinates with partner schools to receive daily attendance reports and test results and formally hires employees from each partner organization to meet required student-teacher ratios. Having to pick up several salaries without cash in hand from the increased enrollment initially put the district in a bit of a bind, requiring Hicks to submit an attendance adjustment to TEA in October, which was granted. He will have to do the same again this coming year, he said. In order to handle the additional administrative load and grow the Early Childhood Education Partnership Program, the district hired a Public Education Information Management System, PEIMS, coordinator, in addition to Deputy Superintendent Hartman. Hicks said, so far, the additional administrative burden placed on the district is well worth it. There's no question it's been a challenge, Hicks said, but the benefits of the challenge far outweigh the extra work. Barton said Alpine Montessori didn't have a problem meeting the district's requirements. Attendance tracking took around 5 minutes each day, and the district provided the computers and software required for students' beginning, middle, and end-of-year assessments. She said while Alpine Montessori was already performing student assessments, access to the district's software proved helpful for further identifying students' weaknesses. It was a way to assess them and get reporting through a software system that we wouldn't have otherwise been able to afford, Barton said. If the school district is paying the salary of a private school employee as part of the partnership agreement, the funds come out of the private school's 50% split, Hicks said. Any remaining money is then sent to the private school in the form of a lease payment because FDISD students are using the private school's space. This year, Hicks hired 14 remote employees from private early childhood schools. While they are FDISD employees on paper, they effectively remain employees of the schools where they were already working. Barton was the employee from Alpine Montessori, hired by FDISD this past year. She said it was beneficial not only for the school, which was relieved from paying her salary, but also for her personally, because she worked as a public school teacher in the state of Texas for 16 years before switching over to the Montessori school. She was able to continue to contribute to her Teacher Retirement System, TRS, account. Alpine Montessori and Barton will benefit from the same agreement next year, but with a different partner district, Alpine ISD. Alpine Christian School will remain with FDISD. Hicks said, in his opinion, it is not a matter of competition as to who can secure these partnerships, but a matter of best fit, with partners mutually agreeing on the level of involvement they would like to have. Alpine ISD Superintendent Michelle Reinhart said, in her opinion, local school districts should have the right of first refusal. Hicks said there are plenty of partnerships to go around, and he certainly doesn't intend to be greedy. FDISD has offered to share how to implement the private early childhood partnership program with neighboring districts, he said. They invited area superintendents to a meeting on the topic, but only Reinhart and an assistant superintendent from Fort Stockton showed up, he said. I sympathize with other area schools that are struggling, Hicks said. We offered to show them how to do it. We said, we'll give you a template. We'll walk you through the process. We'll even help you find a partner that contacted us, but they may be a better fit for you. Reinhart said AISD will use the revenue generated from the Alpine Montessori partnership to pay for a staff member to pursue more partnerships outside of the area. She said while she believes local partnerships are the best case scenario, there are a limited number of early childhood schools in the area, and larger urban districts may not have the capacity to pursue the opportunity with their local schools, leading smaller rural districts to seek partnerships outside of their geographic area. Either way, it's a way to bring more resources to underfunded educational institutions in our community, Reinhart said. Reinhart said the district's goal with the program is to attempt to make up for its estimated 15% loss of state allotment that results from a number of issues, including disputes between the state comptroller and local appraisal district regarding property values, a local option homestead exemption, and more. Could we at least get to a position where we're made whole and receive what the state says we're supposed to be receiving every year, but we're not? Reinhart said. AISD and Alpine Montessori are already working together in some capacities, Reinhart said. The district received a $1 million Stronger Connections grant for student wellness programs, which, due to federal grant requirements, Alpine Montessori will receive a portion of. Because AISD has a relationship with the Texas Workforce Commission due to its daycare facility, and Alpine Montessori holds a Rising Star certification from the state, the Montessori school will receive a one-time $25,000 payment from the state for the new partnership. The private early childhood education partnerships do raise questions about public school dollars funneling into private, potentially religious schools, a hotly debated topic as of late due to Governor Greg Abbott's ongoing push for school vouchers. Alpine Christian School's web homepage notes, "We train our students to view the world and academics through a Christian lens, which includes religious imagery and teachings. So it's clear that students in the private school are receiving a taxpayer-subsidized Christian education." Hicks maintains that the partnerships are keeping his district afloat, even if many questions remain about any state-legislated voucher systems moving forward. "The devil is in the details, and nobody has seen the details," Hicks said. "They can say we want school vouchers, but how are they going to calculate that into my allocation from the state? Nobody has put that out there. How is it going to benefit me? I don't know." Both Reinhart and Hicks agree that the only reason they have to pursue these early childhood education partnerships is because the state is failing to address funding inequities in public education. They would prefer legislators stop pursuing school vouchers and begin to seriously address flaws in the school funding formula, which they failed to do this past legislative session, but that's not the reality they are facing. "If the state would ever fix the funding, yeah, I would love to have that funding. I don't like having a large organization. I don't think it's very efficient," Hicks said, "but I don't have any other choice. It's not like there's an option for me. I have to do it this way." "This is not the only way that more resources could come to our area," Reinhart said. "Legislative leadership and leadership from our state officials to fund public education with funds that the state has could solve this overnight and could have the last legislative session." Staff photo by Maisie Crow. Dirks Anderson Elementary School principal Shara Welch holds student Peyton Zimmerman on one of the last days of the 2022-2023 school year. A year later, the district would embark on enrolling students in classrooms hundreds of miles away. County Board sets course of action for Colonial Water Systems by Rob D'Amico. Rob at BigBenSentinel.com. Presidio County. The county's Utility System Board, at present the exact makeup of the Commissioner's Court, met Wednesday morning along with residents representing the small water systems scattered across the county to bring more focus to next steps to ensure these communities have tested water wells and a process in place to keep their systems safe, financially viable, and mechanically afloat. "I hope we can start moving forward with some of these issues," County Judge Joe Portillo said Tuesday before the meeting. Portillo said he would be unable to attend the meeting because he was traveling to Washington, D.C. on county business. These are issues that, in the past, the county court hasn't really been as involved in. But water is probably one of the most pressing issues that we have. To meet these goals, according to county officials, the board needs to be set up with one board member from each of the county's small water system corporations, Redford, Ruidosa, Candelaria, Shafter, and possibly Las Pampas, which has yet to form a corporation. That has been discussed for months with no action. Also discussed at meetings for more than a year and a half has been small systems pooling revenue to hire someone that could do testing and monitoring for more than one system. It appeared that the meeting was going to adjourn without much progress on any of these ideas when Shafter resident Randall Cater spoke up. Shafter is willing to provide someone for this board. Looking at the speed of progress, what comes to mind is glacial. Trey Gerfers, who is managing water grants for the county, then set a plan in motion. The Utility Systems Board would meet again on July 10th, and each water system should have a person ready to serve on the board to be appointed and replace the county judge and commissioners. Gerfers said he would also seek help from Water Finance Exchange, contracted by the county for water bond administration, to see if they can do financial assessments of the water systems. Finally, the county would try to reconnect with Communities Unlimited, a nonprofit that assists small communities with the development of water systems. That nonprofit had been active in meeting with Shafter residents last year, but never took the initiative to help with what the town was asking, forming its corporation, paying expensive filing fees, and helping organize meetings. The Utility Systems Board was set up to receive and administer $4.6 million in grant money dedicated to improving county water systems. The most pressing need for a new board made up of members from the water systems, according to Portillo, is to get communities in Candelaria and Shafter out of boil water notices and get Candelaria in compliance with requirements of the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, TCEQ, which currently has fines of more than $5,000 levied against Candelaria's water system. Records also show that Candelaria Water Supply Corporation forfeited its corporate status with the state in 2014, and its IRS charitable status has been on auto-revoke since 2011 for not filing 990 tax returns. This is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, June 13, 2024. Obituary. Roy G. Hartnett, a cherished husband, father, and popo, passed away peacefully surrounded by his family on June 5, 2024, in Fort Stockton, Texas, at age 88. He was born on January 1, 1936, in Fort Davis, Texas, to Ramon and Consuelo Hartnett. Roy lived a life marked by faith, love, and laughter, leaving an impression on all who had the pleasure of knowing him. He married the love of his life, Norma Hartnett, in 1958 in Fort Davis, Texas. Together, they laid down roots and raised their family in Marfa, Texas. Their home has always been a place of many family gatherings, filled with sounds of laughter and children playing. Roy was an esteemed auto mechanic who owned and operated Roy's Automotive Shop in Marfa until his retirement. His work ethic and expertise were unparalleled, earning him the respect and admiration of his community. He was a Ford man and loved his Dallas Cowboys. Roy leaves behind his beloved wife of 66 years, daughters Frances Garcia of Alpine and Minerva Leo Sotelo of Andrews, Texas, He was a proud popo to his grandchildren, Amy Jaramillo, Robert Sotelo, Rachel Torres, and Jeremy Roy Hartnett. His great-grandchildren, Christopher and Isabel Jaramillo, Chloe and Max Sotelo, Nolan Jocelyn and Noah Bo Torres, and Ezekiel Roy and Genesis Hartnett, and great-great-grandchildren Giovanni and Liliani Jaramillo. He is also survived by his brothers, Frank Hartnett Sr. and Robert Hartnett, both of Fort Davis, and numerous nieces and nephews. Roy was preceded in death by his parents, Ramon and Consuelo Hartnett, son-in-law Rudy Garcia, and a grandchild, Angel Garcia. Serving as pallbearers are Leo Sotelo, Robert Sotelo, Jeremy Roy Hartnett, John Jaramillo, Sal Torres, and Richard Villanueva, Jr. Honorary pallbearers include Michael Sotelo, Abelardo Marquez, Jr., Richard Granado, Willie Hernandez, Jaime Luna, and Don Culbertson. Services have been entrusted to Alpine Memorial Funeral Home and will take place on Saturday, June 15, 2024, at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Marfa, Texas. Visitation begins at 9:30 a.m., and the Most Holy Rosary will be prayed beginning at 10:30 a.m. The funeral mass begins at 11 a.m., and interment will take place at the Catholic Cemetery in Marfa thereafter.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, May 23rd. MWPISD facing $6.1 million deficit for 24-25. MHS top two grads honored. The story was written by John Cranfield. Monahans Wicked Pyote ISD business manager Katie Jones presented the Board of Trustees with some bad news during the recent regular MWP ISD board meeting. The local district is one of many Texas school districts that will suffer from the loss of formula transition grants. MWP ISD will lose over $2 million when the formula transition grant expires later this year. Formula transition grants were enacted in 2019 when legislators approved House Bill 3, which was to ensure all districts would receive at least a 3% increase in per-student funding. There are 228 districts and charters receiving FTG dollars this year. The FTG statewide cost is capped at $400 million, which, because of rising cost in all areas of operation for schools, is now $231 million short of what is needed. Quote, due to the way we are funded, our 24-25 budget has a preliminary deficit of $6.1 million. This is due primarily to losing over $2 million in formula transition grant funding that was not renewed or replaced in the 80th legislative session, and also due to the increase in expected recapture of $1.3 million, Jones said. Recapture, also known as Robin Hood, allows the state of Texas to remove local property tax dollars from public school districts. Legislators then use these dollars to help balance the rest of the state budget. Recapture began as a limited revenue source for education funding, but it has grown exponentially, now taking nearly $5 billion in property taxes from Texas public school districts per year. According to the website recapturetexas.org, recapture has basically become a shell game. Recapture was created in 1993 to equalize a system that the Texas Supreme Court found to be unconstitutionally inequitable. At that time, the equalization applied to only 34 school districts, and those districts were required to pay less than $130 million in total recapture. Statistics show school districts that lose revenue through recapture educate more than 1.2 million Texas students. Economically disadvantaged students make up more than half the population of districts that lose revenue through recapture. Over the last 10 years, the amount of money that the state removes from school districts through recapture has almost tripled. Taxpayers are required to pay high property taxes when property values rise, and they expect the school district will have a higher amount of revenue. But this is not the case. The higher tax payment means the district will have a larger recapture payment due to the state and the school receive very little. The state gets all the extra money. So, where does the money go? The excess in recapture payments adds to the state's funding surplus. The rise in collections doesn't change anything in the school funding. It only creates a shift in the method of finance used to fund schools. This is because the state no longer has to contribute as much from its own general revenue, which is primarily funded by sales tax, so the extra money gained from higher recapture is put into the state's general revenue, which legislators are free to spend however they see fit. Quote, "I encourage everyone to speak to their representatives and senators about school funding and the lack thereof," said Jones. In other matters, the class of 2024 valedictorian and salutatorian were honored by the school board at the meeting on Monday evening. Valedictorian Shannon Lawson is graduating with a 4.65 grade point average, and salutatorian Caden Sparrow is graduating with a 4.55 GPA. Also introduced and honored were all the students who advanced past district in sports and UIL events, such as Tatum Lighthouse, Unified Track, Band Solo Ensemble, Choir, Solo Ensemble, Tennis, Track, Golf, Softball, UIL Academic Qualifiers, State Honor Crews for Theatrical Design, and Speech and Debate. In other business, details in the Summer Leadership Institute training for school board members was talked about by MWP ISD Superintendent Chad Smith. Quote, "The dates for the training session are June 12th through 14th for Smith, Fine, Upchurch, and Garcia in San Antonio. June 19th through 22nd will be the dates for Steve Tuxhorn in Fort Worth," Smith said. Katie Jones gave the board another report on a budget amendment in the amount of $250,000. A breakdown of cafeteria expenses show a future deficit. Quote, "The rate of food inflation rising cost of equipment could not be foreseen when the budget was set last year and has resulted in contributing to the need for this budget amendment," Jones said. The board approved the request for the $250,000 budget amendment for the cafeteria. After acknowledging no one was present for public comment, the board moved to closed meeting at 8:12 p.m. During the closed session, a consideration for a 2024-2025 compensation plan was presented to the board by Smith. The compensation plan is options for employee salary schedules. Proposed salary schedules are to retain 2023-2024 salary schedules, which is employees that are on a pay step schedule will receive step only, and those not on a step will receive a 2% raise or, as another option, a 2% increase plus step for all employees, or a 3% plus step for all employees. Also in closed session, employment of personnel was discussed, as well as submitted personnel resignations to be considered. After the board reconvened into open session, they approved the employment of several positions for the 2024-2025 school year. After reconvening an open meeting, the compensation plan was tabled for a later date, but all employment requests and resignations were approved. MWP ISD trustees present for the meeting were Bobby Almanza, Josh Schwab, Donna Garcia, Steve Tuxhorn, Nancy Upchurch, and Steve Fine. MWP ISD school board meetings are held on the third Monday of the month at 6:30 p.m. in the Administration Building Boardroom at 606 South Betty. Any individual who has a concern or question can request to be placed on the board meeting agenda. Anyone interested in addressing the Board of Trustees needs to pick up a registration form from the administration office. Individuals may only address issues which are listed on the agenda, which is posted 72 hours before the meeting date. They must be registered to speak by 12 noon on the day of the meeting and will have 4 minutes to speak. The public is encouraged to become involved in affairs concerning our students. MEDC considers making offer on Main Street property. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Monahans Economic Development Corporation board members met in executive session at the end of Monday's regular meeting to discuss purchasing a property located at 719 South Main Street. The 0.288-acre tract of land, which is located just north of Sonic Drive-In, currently has a home on the property and is listed online for $99,500. After convening into regular session, the board approved letting Camilla Blum with Heritage Real Estate negotiate an offer on the property. In other business, the board approved a scope of work agreement for engineering services with Newton Engineering. The board recently approved a proposal from Newton Engineering after actively seeking for an engineering company to replace former engineer Maverick Engineering. Newton will be tasked with engineering a plan for a 12-acre commercial tract of land, Block 25, in the East Monahan subdivision at a cost of $129,250. Agreement includes boundary survey, replat of block, drainage plan, civil engineering plan for retail or commercial development, bidding assistance, water and sewer line construction staking, curb and gutter construction staking. The board also approved a conceptual master plan for the East Monahan subdivision with LAI Design Group at a cost of $5,760. The contract states the group will revise the 2019 master plan for development of the subdivision. In final contract approvals, the board approved a contract with Rubio's Paving for Block 26 at a cost of $813,000. In regular business, the directors approved accounts payable for the month of May, totaling $293,000, which included $280,000 to SAI Monahans for the buyback of Block 27, which was sold to them for the intent of building a hotel in 2019, and $6,900 for payroll and salaries. The financial report reflecting a balance of $3.3 million in available funds, minutes of the April 22nd regular meeting, the May director's report, and the Monahan's apartment study were all approved. Directors present were Richard Irwin, Chad Beard, Leticia Rodriguez, Mary Elena Sines, and Kathy Anthony. Traffic stop nets 14.4 grams of meth. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Monahan's Police Department officers seized approximately 14.4 grams of suspected methamphetamine during a routine traffic stop last Monday night. According to Monahan's Police Department Chief of Police, quote, officers conducted a traffic stop around 11:48 p.m. on May 13th on a vehicle in the 1200 block of West 2nd Street for driving without headlights. Officers spoke to the driver, later identified as Jennifer Hendrick Navarez, age 38, of Monahans, and a passenger, Jesus Daniel Delgado Moran, age 27, of Fort Davis. Quote, "Due to the smell of burnt marijuana emitting from the vehicle, officers conducted a probable cause search where a baggie containing 9.9 grams of suspected methamphetamine was located in the center console of the vehicle. Officers also located a vape pen containing suspected THC in the vehicle," end quote. While in custody at the Ward County Jail, an additional baggie containing 4.5 grams of suspected methamphetamine was located on Delgado Moran's person. Both Navarez and Delgado Moran were charged with possession of a controlled substance, penalty group 1, 4 grams or more, but less than 200 grams, a first-degree felony, and Delgado Moran was charged additionally with the prohibited substance in correctional facility. Navarez's bond was posted at $20,000, and she posted the bond and was released. Delgado Moran's bonds were listed as $20,000 and $12,000. He was released to Immigration Customs Enforcement. If convicted, both Navarez and Delgado Moran could face 15 to 99 years confinement in prison and or a fine up to $10,000. City takes action on Allen Street home. City crews were on the job early last Wednesday morning with bulldozer and dump trucks to demo a burnt home on Allen Street. The house at 1403 South Allen caught fire on October 6, 2023, and was totally destroyed and has remained in the same state since the fire. Although the direct cause of the fire was unknown, it was believed to have begun in the back of the house. Since that time, the City Council proceeded to take action against the owner to repair or remove the house and return the property to City Code requirements. In the months since the first public hearing, the house has not been cleaned up, and a second public hearing on the home was addressed by the Council in February, giving the owner 10 days to comply and clean the property and demo the home. Since the owner did not comply with the city request to clear the property, the city itself has taken over the process to demo and remove the house. The city will place a lien on the property for the cost of the demolition, which will have to be paid before the property could be sold. Early voting ends Friday for runoff, Election Day Tuesday. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Early voting for a pair of runoff races will conclude on Friday, May 24th, with Election Day next Tuesday. As of Tuesday night, 159 in-person ballots have been cast and 5 mail-in ballots have been received. Locally, Republican candidates Billy Redmond and Bill Clayton will face off for Ward County Commissioner Precinct 3. On Election Day in March, after the ballots were counted, Clayton and Redmond were separated by one vote, 251 to 250. Due to neither candidate having more than half of the votes, forced the runoff on May 28th. Redmond and Clayton beat out fellow Republican candidate Robert Vasquez, who garnered 116 of the total 612 votes. The winner of the runoff will run unopposed in the November general election. Republican Tony Gonzalez will look to remain seated as the United States Representative for District 23 as he once again faces Brandon Herrera in the runoff election. The winner of the District 23 Republican runoff election will face Democrat Santos Limon in November. The Republican runoff election voting places have been consolidated only for the runoff election on May 28th. On Election Day, all voting precincts, with the exception of Grand Falls, will vote at the Ward County Event Center. This includes all of Monahans, Pyote, Wickett, and Barstow.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.